gnome. They're all dead.
What's the matter?
They're all dead. I came home and they're all dead.
Hey you, and welcome. My name is Mike, and in this old podcast, we are off down under, and then down a bit further, and then like west a bit. Yeah, it's New Zealand for this one, and for a gruesome family story of murder, that whole kind of skedaddle. Yeah, settle in. The Bain family, and I mean, come on, like with that name, guys, for fuck's sake, come on, guys. They were living in Dunedin, and they were up to no good. Classic Kiwis, am I right? Always up to something. You know, personally, if I can just tell you a little bit about Mike for a second, never been to New Zealand. Nor the new one, nor the old Zealand, which I believe is in the Netherlands, I think. But you know what? Let me tell you this. I've seen The Lord of the Rings, so I kind of feel like I've been there. You know, spiritually, at least. Now, this case is notorious worldwide, but, you know, obviously, especially in New Zealand, for presenting a unique legal conundrum. A conundrum that kind of lasts to this very day, because it only could have been one of two people that done did it. But who? Or is it whom? And that is a question that to this day, people still debate about. Now, let's take a look. By that, I mean, give it a goo, of course. On the morning of Wednesday, June 20th, 1994, at 7:09 a.m., a call was placed to 111. That's the New Zealand 911. 24 minutes later, at 7:33 a.m., four police officers arrived at 65 Every Street in Anderson's Bay, a suburban area, houses and not much else, on the edge of the city of Dunedin. After several attempts to contact the occupants and receiving no response, they began looking through the windows for any sign of a disturbance. Through the windows of one of the bedrooms, they were kind of peeking in that very early morning, and they spotted, through the dark shadows of the room, a shape on the floor. It looked like a figure curled up on the ground, like in the fetal position. After kind of trying to talk to this person, talk through the window, persuade them to come and, hey, let us in, the officers then, with no response from this mysterious figure, they forced entry into the property. They went to where they saw that figure, they approached, and then they could see it was a tall, fair-haired man, and he was visibly shaking on the floor, and they could now hear loud sobbing. In between cries, he kept yelling the same haunting phrase over and over again. They're all dead. They're all dead. So who were they, exactly? Well, the crying man who had placed the panicked 111 call just half an hour earlier and was now curled up on the floor of his bedroom, apparently too frantic to even open the door, that figure was 22-year-old David Cullen Bain. And throughout the dilapidated house at 65 Every Street, he called home, were the rest of his troubled family. And as David was saying, they were all dead. All had been shot to death. Robin Bain and Margaret Cullen married in Dunedin, New Zealand in 1969 and would go on to have four children together. David, Arawa, Laniette were each born 2 years apart, starting with David the oldest in 1972. The youngest child, Stephen, in 1980. The first of the two children were born in Dunedin, and the second pair would be born in Papua New Guinea, if you can believe that, where the Baines had to relocate to in 1974. Robin, he worked as a teacher as part of his missionary work. Very, very religious fellow. He's a big fan of the guy upstairs. The Baines, they moved back to Dunedin in 1988 when David was just 16 years old. And while the rest of the family, they were very happy, you know, they were delighted and excited to be back in New Zealand, David himself, the oldest child who probably would have had the most experience in, you know, Papua New Guinea, he missed it. He missed the culture, he missed the people back there. 3 years after they moved back to New Zealand, Robin took the job of a headmaster at a school. and all four Bain children attended the nearby Bayfield High School in Anderson's Bay, called Andy's Bay. You know what the locals call it, Andy's Bay? And I think I might just do. Stephen, the youngest, he was 14 years old at the time of his death. Now, according to some people who knew the family, what had been going on, there had been strife. Margaret and Robin, the parents, they'd been having some marital issues for a couple of months prior to their deaths. Robin, during the week, he would stay at work. He would stay at the schoolhouse, often accompanied by his youngest daughter, Lenyette. He would only come home at the weekends, but even then, he slept in a caravan in the front garden of the Bain house on every street. He wasn't even sleeping in the same bed as his wife, never mind, you know, even the goddamn same, under the same roof. The Baines were seen as kind of odd by kind of everybody who knew them. All their neighbors and friends would say, you know, they're just a bit quirky, a bit weird. Let the record show, I'm doing hand gestures. I like to do videos where I put my finger and my thumb together and I make an O and then I make that O weird. They were like that. They all had their own secrets. Quite a few, we will get to that, folks. And there was certainly an unusual family dynamic. Like, obviously, okay, the parents, they didn't even sleep together in the same bed. The dad, he spent most of the week away from the rest of his family, and much of running of the actual household was left to the eldest daughter, Arawa, the second child after David. Margaret, now the mother, she was the queen bee of the Bain family. She wore the trousers, but Arawa would pretty much do all the work in the house, and Margaret kind of just faffed about, is the best way to say it. She didn't work, she kind of didn't really do anything. Like, Lanyette told a friend one time that even though Robin was the one working and Margaret was the one staying at home, Robin would give his entire paycheck to his wife and she would give him 20 New Zealand dollars back and be like, there you go, keep up the good work, slugger, while she would do God knows what with the rest of the money. She was kind of like his pimp, actually, now that I mention it. Tough woman. Not tough enough.
Police finally started moving the bodies of the slain family late this afternoon. The sole survivor was comforted by ambulance staff shortly after the carnage in Dunedin. Police were called to this house in Anderson's Bay just after 7 o'clock, and it turned out to be a house of horrors.
Now, on the day of the murders, which was a Wednesday, Robin was sleeping in the caravan that very day. It was a weekday. He would normally stay in the schoolhouse during the week, but this day, he didn't. Now, normally, David, he would wake up to his alarm at 5:30 a.m. He would get dressed in shorts and a t-shirt, and he would go out in his paper round every morning, make a few dollary dues, and he would usually, you know, be out the door by about 5:45 a.m. Robin was woken by the alarm in the caravan that day at 6:30 a.m. And afterwards, when he was at home, he would usually go inside the main house and kneel, have a bit of an El Pray, and then go about his morning routines. David, he would arrive home around 15 minutes after Robin had gotten up at around 6:45 a.m. And then, you know, they would go about their own day, do their own thing. Some of these timings will come up as kind of important later on. Robin, when he was at home, he would be up by 6:30 a.m. And David would be home after his job by 6:45 a.m. That was the normal routine, but nothing was normal about this day, the 20th of June, 1994. When the police arrived to that two-story house after that panicked 111 call, lying in the living room opposite David's bedroom was the body of David's 58-year-old father, Robin Bain. And next to him was David's .22 semi-automatic Winchester rifle, with a gunshot wound to his left temple. The means of Robert's death seems pretty clear. Next to be found was David's 18-year-old sister, Lenyette. She had been shot in the head 3 times at close range. In the master bedroom of the house was the matriarch of the Bain family, 50-year-old Margaret. Like her daughter and her husband, she too had been shot in the head. On the lower level of the house, the body of David's eldest sister, 19-year-old Arawa Bain. She was found in her bed with a gunshot wound to the head. Last to be found, in a room adjacent to Margaret's bedroom that the police initially thought it was a wardrobe, in that bedroom was the body of the youngest of the Bain children. 14-year-old Stephen Bain, He had been killed with a gunshot wound to the head, like the others, but it seems that unlike the others, who had been taken by surprise or even killed while they were sleeping, 14-year-old Stephen had faced his killer head-on, and only succumbed after putting up a fierce fight for his life. As a result, he'd suffered more than his siblings or his parents. Not only had Stephen been shot twice in the head, he'd also been shot through his hand, as well as several cuts and bruises consistent with an attempt, to fight off whoever had done this. And a blood-soaked t-shirt was wrapped around his neck. Though it was later determined that Stephen had been killed by the headshots, the t-shirt had likely been an earlier attempt to try and subdue him and bring him down, maybe even choke him out. And bloody sock prints surrounded the body.
Police finally started moving the bodies of the slain family late this afternoon. The sole survivor was comforted by ambulance staff shortly after the carnage in Dunedin.
The police made a search of the house and located the bodies of five persons. All had been shot in the head, and a .22 caliber rifle was also located at the address near one of the bodies. Some of the deceased persons were in bed, while others were found on the floor alongside beds.
The family of Robin Bain was all but wiped out. Only his eldest son, David, survives of the six.
We believe that there has been either a homicide-suicide or a homicide, but our inquiries obviously are directed towards establishing exactly what's happened, and we can't reach any conclusion until those inquiries are completed.
Once all five deceased members of the Bain family were discovered, a final, chilling discovery was made. In an alcove of the living room, the family they'd built kind of a small home office area, and beside a blinking cursor on the screen was a 10-word note to the only surviving Bain child. "Sorry, you are the only one who deserved to stay." In David's initial statement to the police, he said that the first person he found was his mother. He next ran into the living room where he found his father. He then claimed, he must have gone into shock because he couldn't even remember exactly what he did and what happened in the intervening minutes until the police arrived. He just kind of blanked out. He claimed that he came home from his usual early morning paper round and he went through some of his normal routine before discovering his mother's body. But that became more and more suspect as time went on, and police found further inconsistencies in the facts and his version of events. David said he remembered getting home at around 6:45 a.m. and he had gone straight to his bedroom where, without turning on the light, he took off his running shoes and went into the laundry room where he put his shirt from that week's deliveries, as well as a green sweater, some track pants, and a pair of socks. He then washed his hands in the sink next to the machine to get the ink from the newspapers, off his hands. Not only was there later found to be blood on the light switch in David's room, and he claimed he didn't turn on the light, blood was also found in several areas of the washroom, the basin, a shower cap, a face mask, and a large amount of blood on a green towel that was hung up on a rail. That blood belonged to Robin, his dad. The clothing David was wearing when the police arrived were also found to have blood on them. There was blood on his shorts, the back of his shirt, and on the soles of his socks. All of the blood on the clothes he was wearing was later found to have belonged to his young brother, Stephen. How did Stephen's blood get on his clothing if he said he only found his mother and his dad? Next to the washing machine was a basket of clothes ready to be washed, including another one of David's sweatshirts, which was also found to have blood on it. In Stephen's room, the police found a pair of blood-drenched gloves, white piano gloves, that belonged to David. At the site where the struggle between Stephen and his killer took place, police found what many considered to be the most damning piece of evidence against David, a single loose lens from a pair of glasses that were later found, sans lens, in David's room. Only David and his mother wore glasses. David had several injuries that he also had no explanation for, including scratches and bruises on his torso and a rather large bump on his forehead. So this was not looking good for David, as you can probably guess, this fucking guy. A half-assed attempt at cleaning the scene and then a half-assed attempt at blaming someone else when he himself had injuries, right? And it's an interesting scene though, five people shot dead, no one ran from the house. In fact, it seems only one person was aware of the shooting, Stephen as he fought back? Like, did the shots not wake up the others? Were they so deep asleep? Well, it was found a silencer was used on the rifle. Despite David's own insistence that he did not touch the rifle that morning, and in fact he hadn't even been aware of its presence when he found his father's body, bloody fingerprints belonging to David were also found on the rifle that had been used to wipe out his entire family. It was David's rifle, and there was a silencer on the rifle, as in he wanted to eliminate his whole family quietly. David, he said he only ever used that rifle to hunt possums. Clearly, he was now using it to hunt something else. Another one of the more glaringly obvious inconsistencies in David's story was that he said in the call to emergency services, "My family, they're all dead." But in his statements, he told police he'd only seen his parents' bodies by that point. So not looking great for David. All of this drew a hell of a lot of suspicion on David only 4 days after he claimed to have discovered the bodies of his family, and then he was charged with all five of their murders, eventually going on trial a year later. At what would become David Bain's first trial for the murder of his family, the prosecution's case largely relied on the inconsistencies between David's statements to the police and the physical scene itself. Now, the importance of any physical scene, you know, during any murder case, you know, obviously it can't be underestimated, right? But in this case, it was still kind of murky. Later on, even before the trial happened, the house at 65 Every Street where the murders took place, it was burned to the ground. Apparently done with the permission of David and, well, any of his, you know, extended family who were still alive. Like, this would still have been an active, you know, investigation until the trial. Could the police not have preserved it till then, you think? Maybe just don't burn it down till, you know, we got a conviction here. You know, that's a thinker. Maybe. But luckily, the police had already gathered a fair amount of evidence and samples from the house before it was washed away for good, or rather, burned away for good. So much so that despite a not guilty plea from David, the prosecution were able to offer a strong enough case that after an 18-day trial on the 29th of May, 1995, David Cullen Bain was found guilty on all five counts of murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison. Sounds about right, you're Darren Tootin. You know, I think it seems pretty clear that the injuries he had on him, the blood, his whole story, it seems very likely that he killed his own family and then, you know, tried to blame it on somebody else.
The man convicted of killing his parents, two sisters and brother, said it's a crime he didn't commit.
I know I am not the monster, the perpetrator of this whole thing that I've been portrayed as.
And that, you know, would have been it, except something else then happened. Well, what happened then was the commitment and persistence of David's supporters, and he had quite a few, and a new defense team. His new defense team would actually end up being led by a man named Joe Karam, a former rugby player and member of the All Blacks, who had been approached one day by a group of people fundraising for David's appeal. They approached Joe and he listened to their story and he actually found it extremely fascinating. He decided to learn more about it and read up on it. He ended up essentially becoming a self-taught lawyer and represented David in the eventual appeal, helping him enormously in the retrial. David's appeal, it was actually unsuccessful at first, falling at the first hurdle several times, but being victorious after being heard by the Privy Council. The Privy Council was the equivalent of, you know, what is now called the Supreme Court of New Zealand, and that would, you know, that was literally his last chance at appeal. The appeal was largely based on the idea of Robin Bain, his dad, being a more likely killer.
I know that I did not do it. I know that completely, you know, there is no question about that. I mean, I've done a lot of soul searching and wondering if I did, whether I did in a blackout or not, but I know I did not do it. It only leaves my father, doesn't it?
Remember the note. You know, David, you're the only one who can stay alive. Weirdly written on a computer. If Robin Bain wrote it, you think he would write it in his handwriting, because then it would be provably that Robin had done it. But, you know, anyway. That was, you know, one clue, whether it was real or not, one clue that David hadn't did it. But there was a couple other ones that threw doubt on David being guilty. The blood on the rifle was tested. It came back positive for human DNA. The DNA of his victims, as you can imagine. However, on the rifle were also certain spots of blood where David's fingerprints were. Now, that wasn't tested at the time, and when it finally was tested in 1997 by David's own team, it came back as not being human DNA. David's reasoning that he used the rifle to hunt possums could actually have been reasonable. Though there was human blood on the rifle, other patches of blood that had David's fingerprints wasn't his family's blood. There was also testimony from a friend of Lanyette's, a guy named Dean Cole, and Dean told the court, but not the jury, that prior to her murder, Lanyette had confided in him that she'd been sexually assaulted and abused by her father, Robin, for years, and she'd been planning on confronting him in front of the rest of the family. If this is true, it gives a very good reason for Robin, you know, wanting to commit a heinous crime. His testimony, however, wasn't allowed to be admitted in the trial as one incident he failed to appear despite a subpoena. And when he did actually appear, he was like incoherent. He couldn't really tell anything. He wasn't a very reliable witness. And another thing was the sock prints in blood around Stephen's body. Now, they weren't ever able to be tested properly, and everything had to be done from photographs of the scene due to, you know, the house itself being burned down. But when the prints were measured from the photographs, they were found to be more likely Robin's foot size than David's. Though David's team, they didn't use this in the initial trial as, well, David said he could have, you know, stepped in the body as he checked on his family. The defense didn't have a clue how big, you know, that would become a big part of the prosecution's case against him. And remember David, after he said he found his parents, he kind of went into this like fugue state. He wasn't really sure where he had gone or what he had done, whose bodies he had been around. As a result of Joe Karam's tireless work, the Privy Council actually declared in a 46-page judgment that there had been a substantial miscarriage of justice, resulting in David being released on bail in May 2007 after more than a decade in prison. Importantly, while the council had found that justice had not been done, that didn't mean David was not guilty. And so another trial was possible. David's retrial would come in 2009. The new trial actually began with the judge reading aloud the entirety of David Bain's cross-examination from the first trial. Not exactly a normal thing to happen, but a lot of things in this case were not normal at all. Right, in the first trial, the trial where he was found guilty, the prosecution, they made quite a lot of Robin Bain being found to have a full bladder at the time of his death. Weird, I know. He was full of pee when he died. There you go. But they surmised from this that if Robin Bain had been the one to kill his family, surely he would have gone to the bathroom first, right? Well, I'm convinced. You know, if you're ever going for a long drive or have to kill your entire family, make sure you use the restroom. If, on the other hand, he had been taken by surprise by his son hiding in the shadows while Robin kneeled, you know, for his morning prayer, a full bladder, you know, made a lot of sense. In the retrial, David's defense, they pointed that him having a full bladder didn't mean anything. As it kind of shouldn't, I suppose. The full bladder issue, it's something that in most trials would be insignificant. Barely even warrant a mention. But this trial, it's all about these small little things that suddenly become a big deal for or against David Bain, really. You had two suspects, David or Robin, but a lot of this shit was pointing at David. He had bruises, he had scratches, he had bloody clothing, but then the defense would always somehow find a reason for why this was. The bruises and scratches he got them, you know, while he was out in his mail run. He had blood on his clothing. Well, he had walked around, you know, looking at his murdered family. By the time the second trial came around, the defense, and in particular Joe Karam, they really had their ducks in a row and had plausible, if not necessarily probable, refutations for each of the prosecution's points. The prosecution, on the other hand, they really didn't bring anything new, were overconfident, possibly, probably based on knowing that public opinion was largely against David. Most people thought David Dunn did it. And another out there contribution from witness testimony was the mental state of Margaret Bain. According to multiple friends of the family, Margaret, she'd become interested in New Age spiritualism and had begun referring to her husband, Robin, as the Son of Belial, or Crown Prince of Hell. Hell yeah! In addition, Margaret apparently also believed strongly in past lives and possession, and believed at various times that either herself or multiple members of the family were possessed by a malevolent spirit. Righto. A neighbour of the Baines, Barbara Short, she described Robin as a very loving, patient guy who was trying to keep the family together. And she also said that Margaret and Robin were very patient and kind with each other. But of course, she didn't know what was going on behind closed doors. Still, she was saying, you know, there's no way Robin would just snap and murder his own family. It must have been David. But again, in refutation, the defense had colleagues of Robin's saying, oh, he had become, you know, increasingly disheveled, disorganized, untidy. It appeared he was really struggling at work. He was getting really, really stressed. He would even be three times more stressed after he had just spent time with his family. Also raised at the retrial was the issue of the loose glasses lens that had again been considered one of the prosecution's strongest pieces of evidence. The first time around, an optometrist testified that he would have thought the glasses belonged to a man due to the masculine look of the frames, and that in order to remove the lens, you know, a lot of pressure would have been required. But in the retrial, that same optometrist changed his opinion based on new photographs that were presented. And he said, well, actually, now that you've given me new photographs from a different perspective, these could be a woman's glasses easily. And what about those incest allegations against Robin and Lagnette? Well, again, in the rest of the story, both sides have arguments for and against it. Like, one person was saying Robin was abusing his own daughter, right? But also at the same time, Lagnette would stay a lot with her dad at the schoolhouse. And then another friend, though, would also say Lagnette was telling stories that there was something going on between her and David. You know, this witness would say that her and David were in some kind of sexual relationship, that they were often more like girlfriend and boyfriend than brother and sister. And further muddying the waters and distorting the truth about what was really going on with Lagnette, another friend of hers told the court that Lagnette had recently confided in her that she'd begun working as a sex worker. Whether or not anyone else knew, she couldn't say, but she knew for certain that neither Robin nor David knew. There's so many stories here, it seems like each friend had a different secret that Lagnette had confided in them. Were any of these things true? Was Lagnette just telling stories to anyone who would listen? Was there any proof of any of this? Was there any proof of any of the allegations that were made about the family and the type of people they were? It's an extremely messy, messy, messy case. The prosecution proposed that rather than kill all five members of his family before putting his clothes in the wash and going out for an early morning run and paper round, David actually killed his siblings and mother first and didn't kill his father until after his paper round, and then put his clothes, you know, put his clothes away, calling the police. Now, investigators, they ruled out the first scenario that David killed everyone and then went to work and called the police when he got back, as Robin's body was still warm to the touch when the police arrived at the scene. So he couldn't have been killed, you know, more than an hour before the police showed up. His body being found in the living room also meant that it was likely Robin had risen and had been, you know, up and about at the time of his death, with the alarm in his trailer being set for 6:30 a.m. That would mean he woke after David had gone out on his round and had been killed when David got back. So that's the, you know, the scenario the prosecution went with. That David killed his siblings and his mother, then went down his paper round, came back and killed his dad. But that seems kind of also improbable. Like, what if his dad had just happened to get up early? What if his dad found the rest of the family that morning before David got back? It's pretty stupid to have done that. That doesn't really make any sense at all. The defense, however, argued that David did indeed wake, as usual, at 5:30 a.m. and he left the house 15 minutes later. Then at 6:30 a.m, Robin woke, put on David's piano gloves, which why would he put on David's piano gloves at all? If the defense's story is true, why would he do that? But he did, according to the defense, killed the family, and then turned the gun on himself. And again, the gun that was used was a rifle. Kind of hard to shoot yourself. Apparently, he balanced the butt of the rifle on a chair, put his barrel to the temple, and then stretched out with his arm and pulled the trigger that way. And about the note that was written on the computer, the note that said, "Sorry, you are the only one who deserved to stay," the note that was directed towards David Bain, is so weird. During the first trial, a forensic analyst determined that the computer was turned on at 6:44 a.m. Now, this was later disputed by the defense, who claimed that the timing was off and yada yada yada. But basically, they were saying the computer had been turned on and the note written before David would have returned home from his paper route. And speaking of David returning home from his paper route, a passing driver swore that she saw David at 6:50 a.m. That David Bain, he was running late on his paper route that very day. There's no way he could have written the note because it was written way before he arrived home. Those 10 words, they're going to be pretty infamous. "Sorry, you were the only one who deserved to stay." According to people who knew the family, David and Robin, they weren't very close. But David, of course, he would say, "Oh yeah, they were really close. I shared a lot of interests with my old man." Almost everything in this case is up for contention. Except one thing. Whoever killed Robin Bain killed the rest of the family. And how Robin Bain died, there was no final determination on how that would have happened. Whether the fatal gunshot wound was taken from away from him or was directly pressed, you know, against his head. The analysts, the pathologists, they couldn't determine whether it had been done or not. One doctor said there was a contact wound, so it must have been pressed against his head when Robin Bain was killed, which would lead you to believe he had done it to himself. Two others, though, disagreed. They said that the gun was at least a foot away from him when he was shot. So therefore, it couldn't be suicide. I think most people would agree that there are problems with both the prosecution's and the defense's case. Neither story here seems likely that David did it or his father did it. It was the Invisible Man who did it. He killed the Bain family. None of these things make sense at all. They're all both equally unlikely. There's problems with both sides of both cases. But in the end, the reasonable doubt won out. David Bain was found not guilty of all charges related to his family's death. Now, this sparked a debate in New Zealand that carried on for years and to an extent to this very day. Although, you know, he'd been found not guilty by the jury, in the court of public opinion, people were thinking David Bain had murdered his entire family and had now gotten away with it. Throwing even more fuel on the fire was the argument over damages. After all, David had been found not guilty, but he had served a decade in prison for a crime he didn't commit.
The government's currently considering a compensation claim from David Bain. The report by former Canadian Judge Ian Binney recommending compensation focused on hearsay, not facts.
So following a review by a retired ex-justice, David was eventually, he was paid money because he had, you know, been wrongly imprisoned. He was paid about $1 million. Not a, you know, an outrageous sum, but more than most thought he should have gotten. And it's also worth noting that the retired ex-justice who wrote a whole report about David, you know, being wrongly imprisoned, he also concluded in that same report that, in all probability, David was guilty. So he essentially wrote a report saying, "We gotta give David about $1 million because he was wrongly imprisoned," kind of question mark. So where is David Bain today? Well, technically, he does not exist anymore. He later changed his name to William David Cullen Davies, taking his wife's name in 2017, and he later had a daughter. And rarely, bizarrely, and kind of ironically, in June 2017, the Crown deemed there to be no reason to hang onto the many exhibits gathered for the first two trials, so they began disposing of items of evidence. One of those was the murder weapon itself, David's .22 Winchester rifle, which was returned to David. I mean, if he did it, maybe he would want it as a keepsake, and if he didn't do it, why would he want it? His own gun that had murdered his parents and his siblings. Really, really weird. Following his acquittal, after a struggle, he eventually found work at an engineering firm in Auckland. There are so many unusual and problematic parts to the Bain family murders, it's unlikely we'll ever know the exact truth of what happened that morning.
Michael Bain really gives interviews about the murders of five members of his family, for which his nephew David Bain was convicted, then acquitted.
If Robin had ever been charged, with this tragedy that he would not have been found guilty because there was just no evidence against him.
There were no fingerprints of Robbins found on the murder weapon. Michael Bain says he's never doubted Robbins' innocence, and nothing in the new claims has changed his mind.
But if Robin was the killer, as, you know, the jury decided, and so legally speaking, he is the killer of his own family, why did he go out of his way to frame his own son by using his son's weapon, wearing his son's gloves, and then just kind of doing weird shit that would make his son look like the killer? But then also, in addition to framing his son, write a note trying to clear his son. Whichever way you look at this case, whether he did it or David did it, neither way is good. And on that bombshell, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to this whole case. It's a really batshit one, which, as I said, I don't think we'll ever really get to the bottom of. But as always, please, if you'd like to listen to some more That Chapter podcasts, check them out. And of course, it goes without saying, check out the That Chapter YouTube channel for new videos every week. But until the next one, please do take care of each other and yourselves, because I love you. Mike out.